That's Amore. Beside our apartment building in New York, there was a narrow gangway, and every evening, just after dark, rats would emerge from it and flock to the trash cans lining the curb. The first time I saw them, I started and screamed, but after that, I made it a point to walk on the other side of the street, pausing and squinting to take them all in. It was like moving to Alaska and seeing a congregation of bears. I knew to expect them, but still I could never quite believe my eyes. Every now and then, one of them would get flattened by a cab, and I'd bend over the body, captivated by the foulness of it. 20, maybe 30 seconds of reverie, and then the spell would be broken, sometimes by the traffic, but more often by my neighbor, Helen, who'd shout at me from her window. Like the rats that spilled from the gangway, she was exactly the type of creature I'd expected to find living in New York. Arrogant, pushy, proudly, almost fascistically opinionated, she was a person you found yourself quoting at dinner parties, especially if your hosts were on the delicate side and you didn't much care about being invited back. Helen on politics, Helen on sex, Helen on race relations. The response at the table was almost always the same. Oh, that's horrible. And where do you know this person from? It was Hugh who first met her. This was in New York, on Thompson Street, in the fall of 1991. There was a combination butcher shop and cafe there, and he mentioned to the owner that he was looking to rent an apartment. While talking, he noticed a woman standing near the door, 70 at least, and no taller than a 10-year-old girl. She wore a sweatsuit, tight through the stomach and hips. It wasn't the pastel-colored, ladylike kind, but just plain gray, like a boxer's. Her glasses were wing-shaped, and at their center, just over her nose, was a thick padding of duct tape. Helen, she said her name was. Hugh nodded hello, and as he turned to leave, she pointed to some bags lying at her feet. Carry my groceries upstairs. She sounded like a man, or rather, a hitman, her voice coarse and low, like heavy footsteps on gravel. Now? Hugh asked. She said, what? You got something better to do? They walked into the building next door, a tenement, and were on the second floor, slowly climbing to the fifth, when she told him of a vacant apartment. The former tenant had died a month earlier, and his place would be available in a week or so. Helen was not the super or the manager. She had no official title, but was friendly with the landlord, and thus had a key. I can let you have a look, but that doesn't mean that you're going to get it. As one bedrooms went, this was on the small side, narrow too, and as low-ceilinged as a trailer. The walls were covered with cheap, dark paneling, but that could be gotten rid of easily enough. What sold Hugh was the ferocity of the sunlight, that and the location. He got the address of the landlord, and before leaving to fill out an application, he gave this Helen woman $75. Just for showing me the place, he told her. She stuffed the money down the front of her sweatshirt, and then she made sure that we got the apartment. I first saw it a few days later. Hugh was in the living room, taking down the paneling, while I sat on a paint bucket and tried to come to terms with my disappointment. For starters, there was the kitchen floor. The tiles there were brown and tan and ochre, the colors seemingly crocheted as they would be on an Afghan. Then there was the size. I was wondering how two people could possibly live in such a tight space when there was a knock at the unlocked door, and this woman I didn't know stepped uninvited onto the horrible tiles. Her hair was dyed the color of a new penny, and she wore it pulled back into a thumb-sized ponytail. This put the focus on her taped-up glasses and on her lower jaw, which stuck out slightly, like a drawer that hadn't quite been closed. "Can I help you?" I asked, and her hand went to a whistle that hung from a string around her neck. Mess with me and I'll stick my foot so far up your ass I'll lose my shoe. Someone says this and you naturally look down, or at least I do. The woman's feet were tiny, no longer than hot dog buns. She had on puffy sneakers, cheap ones made of air and some sort of plastic, and considering them, I frowned. They might be small, but they'll still do the job. Don't you worry, she said. Right about then, Hugh stepped out of the living room with a scrap of paneling in his hand. Have you met Helen? He asked. The woman unfurled a few thick fingers, the way you might when working an equation. Two young men plus one bedroom minus ugly paneling equals fags. Yeah, we met. Her voice was heavy with disdain. We met all right. For the first few weeks that we lived in the apartment, Helen clearly preferred Hugh over me. My boyfriend, she called him. Then the two of them got to talking, and she switched her allegiance. I knew I'd won her favor when she invited me into her kitchen. Owing to her Sicilian blood, Helen had an innate gift for cooking. This she boasted as she jammed meatballs into a frozen store-bought pie crust. Then she drowned them in a mixture of beaten eggs and skim milk. My famous Italian quiche, she called it. Other dishes included my famous eggplant parmesan with the veal in it, my famous tomato gravy with rice and canned peas, and my famous spaghetti and baked bean casserole. If Helen's food was truly famous, it was so in the way of sun poisoning and growling dogs with foam on their lips, things you avoided if you knew it was good for you. If I was super stoned, I might wash the sauce off a bit of veal and eat it atop a cracker, but for the most part, her food went straight into the trash can. Throughout the 7 years Hugh and I lived on Thompson Street, our lives followed a simple pattern. He would get up early and leave the house no later than 8. I was working for a house cleaning company, and though my schedule varied from day to day, I usually didn't start until 10. My only real constant was Helen, who would watch Hugh leave the building and then cross the hall to lean on our doorbell. I would wake up, and just as I was belting my robe, the ringing would be replaced by a pounding, frantic and relentless, the way you might rail against a coffin lid if you'd accidentally been buried alive. All right, all right. What were you, asleep? Helen would say as I opened the door. I've been up since 5. In her hand would be an aluminum tray covered with foil, either that or a saucepan with a lid on it. Well, I'd tell her I didn't go to bed until 3. I didn't go to bed until 3:30. This was how it was with her. If you got 15 minutes of sleep, she got only 10. If you had a cold, she had a flu. If you dodged one bullet, she dodged 5, blindfolded. After my mother's funeral, I remember her greeting me with, "So what? My mother died when I was half your age." "Gosh," I said, "think of everything she missed." To Helen, a gift was not something you gave to person number 1, but something you didn't give to person number 2. This was how we wound up with the Singer sewing machine, the kind built into a table. A woman on the 3rd floor made her own clothes, and in her own quiet way, had asked if she could have it. "So you want my sewing machine, do you?" Helen said. "Let me think about it." Then she picked up the phone and gave Hugh and me a call. "I got something for you," she told us. "The only deal is that you can't give it to nobody else, especially nobody who lives in this building on the 3rd floor." "But we don't need a sewing machine," I said. "What are you saying, you already have one?" "Well, no." "All right then, so shut up. Everybody needs a sewing machine, especially this one, top of the line. I can't tell you how many outfits I've made over the years." "Yes, but nothing. It's a present from me to you." As Hugh manhandled it through our door, I tried to block him. "But there's hardly enough room for us," I said. "Where are we supposed to put a full-size sewing machine? I mean, really, why not just give us a tugboat? It would take up the same amount of space." Hugh, though, you really have to hand it to him. He sat on the horrid little bench that came with the machine, and 5 minutes later, he was teaching himself to sew. That's the kind of person he is, capable of anything. "Can you make a body bag?" I asked. Every day for the next 6 months, Helen mentioned her gift. "So how's that Singer? You made any pants yet? You made any jeans?" It was the same with the food she gave us. So did you like the turkey meatloaf with Italian seasoning? Very much. Nobody makes it like me, you know. You won't get any argument here. The food Helen brought us was presented as a slight to the couple next door. The sons of bitches. If they knew I was making this for you, they'd die. The common areas of our building were covered in small ceramic tiles, giving the impression that you were in an empty pool. Even the slightest noises were amplified, so with very little effort, your voice could be deafening. Standing in the hallway outside my door, Helen would shout so loud that the overhead lights would dim. All week they've been trying to beg food off of me. What's that smells so delicious, they want to know. You got any extras that need a good home? We're practically dying of hunger over here. In real life, the couple next door were pleasant and soft-spoken. At the time we moved in, the wife had already developed Alzheimer's, and her husband, an 85-year-old man named Joe, was doing his best to care for her. I never heard him whine or grovel, so that, I suspected, was just wishful thinking on Helen's part. None of her impersonations were very good, but there was no denying her showmanship. She was a dynamic person, and even Joe, whom she was crueler to than anyone, was quick to acknowledge her weird star power. A real pistol, he'd call her. A peach of a girl. Begging off of me when he's got his railroad pension, that plus the Social Security, the both of them can go fuck themselves, Helen would shout. He was the type who'd hear this sort of thing and say, oh, come on now. That's no way to talk about your neighbors. This was why Helen waited until he left for work every morning. He was a downer. Living with someone like that, I'd go crazy, she'd say. Jesus Christ, I don't know how you can stand it. Before moving to New York, I spent 6 years in Chicago. During most of that time, I lived with my then boyfriend, and between the two of us, we seemed to know a fair number of people. There were wild dinners, wild parties, always something fun and druggy going on. Never again would I have so many friends, and such good ones, though I'm not exactly sure why. Perhaps I've grown less likable over the years, or maybe I've just forgotten how to meet people. The initial introduction, the shaking hands part, I can still manage. It's a follow-up that throws me. Who calls whom, and how often? What if you decide after the second or third meeting that you don't really like this person? Up to what point are you allowed to back out? I used to know these things, but now they're a mystery. Had I met Helen when I was in my 20s, we wouldn't have spent nearly so much time together. I'd have been off with people my own age, either taking drugs or looking for them. This as opposed to drinking instant coffee and listening to someone talk about her colitis. When Helen said oil, it sounded like Earl. Subsequently, toilet came out as turlet, as in, I was up and back to the fucking turlet 6 times last night. Shit so hard, I think I sprained my asshole. That we both found this fascinating was, I suppose, proof that we had at least one thing in common. Another thing we could always agree on was a soap opera called One Life to Live. It aired in the early afternoon, and often, when I wasn't working, I'd go across the hall and watch it at her place. Helen had lived in the same apartment for close to 50 years, though you'd never know to look at it. I had stuff everywhere, the sewing machine, for example, but her living room, much like her kitchen, was Spartan. On one wall was a framed photograph of herself, but no pictures of her daughters or any of her 7 grandchildren. There were no chairs either, just a sofa and a coffee table. These faced the room's only extravagance, a tower of 3 televisions stacked one atop another. I don't know why she kept them. The black and white model on the bottom had died years earlier, and the one above it had no volume control. This left the TV at the top of the pile. It blathered away, all but ignored in favor of the window, which afforded a view of the entire block and was Helen's preferred source of entertainment. When in the living room, she usually sat on the radiator, her lower half indoors, and her head and shoulders as far out as they would go. the waitress on the second floor coming home at 2 a.m., the shopkeeper across the street accepting a package from the UPS man, a woman in a convertible applying lipstick. Nothing escaped her attention. During the years I knew her, I'd guess that Helen spent a good 10 hours a day at her window. Mid-mornings, you could find her in the kitchen, but at 11 o'clock, when the soap operas began, she'd switch off the radio and return to her perch. It hurt her neck to turn from the street to the screen, so most programs were listened to rather than watched. Exceptions were made for Friday episodes of One Life to Live, and occasionally for Oprah, who was one of the few black people Helen had any regard for. Perhaps in the past she had been more open-minded, but getting mugged in the foyer of our building convinced her that they were all crooks and sex maniacs, even the light-skinned ones. Talk show hosts were scumbags as well, but Oprah, anyone could see that she was different. While the rest of the pack accentuated the negative, she encouraged people to feel good about themselves, be they single mothers, a group that had included Helen, or horribly disfigured children. I never would have thought about it, but I guess that girl does have a pretty eye, she once said, referring to the young Cyclops fidgeting on the screen. One afternoon, Oprah interviewed a group of women who would overcome seemingly insurmountable obstacles. Susan fell overboard while sailing and managed to survive for 6 days by clinging to a cooler. Colleen taught herself to read and got a job as an executive secretary. The third guest, a poet, had recently published a memoir about her cancer and the many operations performed in an effort to reconstruct her jaw. The poet and I had met and spoken on several occasions. Now here she was on Oprah, and nothing would do until I ran across the hall to tell Helen. She had been half watching from her spot on the radiator and didn't seem terribly impressed with my news. "You don't get it," I said, and I pointed to the screen. "I know that person. She's my friend." It was too strong a word for what was, at best, a nodding relationship, but Helen didn't need to know that. "So what?" she said. "So I have a friend on Oprah." "Big deal. You think that makes you special?" If Helen had known someone who'd appeared on Oprah, she'd have had T-shirts made up. But of course that was different. She was allowed to boast and name drop, but no one else was. Announce an accomplishment, signing a book contract, getting your play reviewed in the Times, and her hackles would go up. "You think your shit smells better than mine? Is that what you're trying to say?" "But you're old," I once told her. "Your job is to be happy for me." "Stick it up your ass," she said. "I'm not your goddamn mother." With the exception of my immediate family, no one could provoke me quite like Helen could. One perfectly aimed word, and within an instant, I was 8 years old and unable to control my temper. I often left her apartment swearing I'd never return. Once I slammed her door so hard her clock fell off the wall, but still I went back, crawled back, as she would say, and apologized. It seemed wrong to yell at a grandmother, but more than that, I found that I missed her, or at least I missed someone I could so easily drop in on. The beauty of Helen was that she was always there, practically begging to be disturbed. Was that a friend, or had I chosen the wrong word? What was the name for this thing we had? When I told Hugh about the Oprah business, he said, "Well, of course she acted that way. You were being pretentious." The word threw me. Pretentious is knowing someone who met Pina Bausch, not someone who met Oprah. "It depends on what circles you're running in," he said. And I suppose that he was right. Not that it gave Helen anything to be snippy about. I'd lost count of all the times she'd mentioned her friendship with John Gotti, head of the Gambino crime family. "He's a very good-looking man," she'd say. "Pictures don't do him justice." After pressing, I learned that by friend, she meant they'd been introduced at a party 30 years earlier and had danced for 2 minutes before someone cut in. "John is very light on his feet," she told me. "That's something most people don't know about him." "Maybe they'll bring it up at his murder trial," I said. Helen fell in the tub and sprained her wrist. "That's it for the cooking," she told us. "You're not getting any more free meals out of me." Hugh and I shuffled back across the hall and shut the door behind us. No more famous veal cutlet. No more famous sausage casserole. No more famous chicken with the oriental vegetables. We could hardly believe our luck. While Helen was laid up, I went to the store for her. Hugh took down her trash and delivered her mail. Joe, a widower now, offered to help as well. "Anything that needs doing around the house, you just let me know," he told her. He meant that he'd change light bulbs or run a mop across her floor, but Helen took it the wrong way and threw him out of her apartment. "He wants to give me a bath," she told me. "He wants to see my twat." It was shocking to hear this word from a 73-year-old woman, and in response, I winced. "What?" she said. "You think I ain't got one?" 3 months after Hugh joined the Scenic Union, the membership voted to go on strike. This is a group that paints backdrops for movies and plays. I wanted to be supportive, and so I tried coming up with slogans that might sound good on a picket sign. "Broadway gives 829 the brush off," was my idea, as was "Scenic Painters Find New Contract Unpalatable." On the first morning of the strike, Hugh left the house at 7 a.m. A short while later, Helen called. I normally wouldn't pick up at that hour, but her voice on the machine was slurred and frantic, and so I answered. Since I had known her, Helen had, in her words, taken 3 strokes. They were, she'd admit, little ones, but still it worried me that she might have had another, and so I got dressed and headed across the hall to her apartment. The door jerked open before I could knock, and she stood in the frame, her lower jaw sunken, the lip invisible. It seemed that she had been at her window, surveying the scene below, and when the super in the building across the street threw a lit cigarette into our trash can, she yelled at him with such force that she blew her lower plate right out of her mouth.
"It's in the shrubs," she said. "Go get it."
A minute later, I was downstairs, searching the planter in front of our building. There I found a beer bottle, a slice of pizza with ants on it, and, finally, the dentures, incredibly unbroken by their 5-story fall. It is not unpleasant to hold someone else's warm teeth in your hand, and before returning upstairs, I paused, studying the damp plastic horseshoe that served as Helen's gum. What made it all look so fake was its perfection. No single tooth protruded or towered above its neighbor. Even in shape and color, they resembled a row of ceramic tiles. Back upstairs, I found Helen waiting on the landing. She slid the dentures, unwashed, back into her mouth, and it was like popping the batteries into a particularly foul toy. "Rat, bastard, motherfucker, could have set our whole building on fire." In the mornings, Helen listened to the radio, an oldie station I referred to as K-Wop. All the singers seemed to be Italian, and all were backed by swollen string arrangements. Whenever a favorite song came on, she'd crank up the volume, subjecting us to countless versions of Volare and That's Amore. Radio meant a lot to Helen, but only her station. When I was invited to record a series of commentaries for NPR, she took no interest whatsoever. The morning my first story was broadcast, she pounded on our door. I was in the bedroom with a pillow over my head, so Hugh answered and gestured to the air around him.
"Listen," he whispered, "David is on the radio."
"So what?" Helen said. "A lot of people are on the radio." Then she handed him an envelope and asked if we'd mail in her stool sample. "It's not the whole thing, just a smear," she told him. When the broadcast was over and I finally got out of bed, I noticed that she'd posted her stool sample with Christmas stamps and included the spidery handwritten message, "Happy Holidays." Our building was full of people who, for one reason or another, had found their way onto Helen's shit list. Some were doomed right from the start. She didn't like their looks or the sounds of their voices. They were stuck up. They were foreign. Our landlord had a small office just off Bleecker Street, and Helen used to call him at least 3 times a day. She was like the secret police, always watching, always taking notes. Then the landlord died, and the building was sold to a real estate conglomerate located somewhere in New Jersey. The new owners didn't care that the woman on the second floor had found a black boyfriend or that the super was composing electronic music instead of improving his English. Overnight, Helen became powerless, and those who had lived in fear of her grew progressively more defiant. You'd think she would hate being called a tattletale or, even worse, a nosy old bitch, but strangely, such names seemed only to invigorate her. "You think I can't kick your ass?" I'd hear her yell. "You mutt! I'll mop the fucking floor with you!" The first few times I heard this, I laughed. Then it was me she was threatening to mop the floor with, and suddenly it didn't seem so funny. This was another of those arguments that came out of nowhere, a word here, a word there, and the next thing I knew, we were at each other's throats. Ironically, the fight started over a blown fuse. My electricity had gone out, and I needed a key to the basement. Helen had one, and when she refused to loan it to me, I told her she was being an asshole. "That's better than being a drunk," she said, and she waited a minute for the word to settle in. "That's right. You think I don't see you with your empty cans and bottles every morning? You think I can't see it in your swollen face?" Had I not been so loaded that I could barely stand, my denial might have carried a bit more weight. As it was, I sounded pathetic. "You don't know anything about what goes on with me." We were in the doorway when she put her hand on my chest and pushed. "You think you're tough? You think I can't kick your ass?" Hugh came up the stairs just then, his ears ringing from all the noise. "You're like children, the both of you," he told us. Following our little scene, Helen and I didn't talk for a month. I'd hear her out in the hall sometimes, most often in the morning, giving food to Joe. "It's my famous pasta fazool, and that one next door, the Greek bastard, would die if he knew I was giving it to you." It was a stranger who brought us back together. In the 10 years or so before she retired, Helen cleaned house for a group of priests in Murray Hill. "They were Jesuits," she told me. "That means they believe in God, but not in toilet paper. You should have seen their underwear. Disgusting." In her opinion, a person who hired a housekeeper was a person who thought himself better than everyone else. She loved a story in which a snob got his comeuppance, but the people I worked for were generally pretty thoughtful. I felt like a bore, telling her how unobtrusive and generous everyone was. And so it came as a pleasant surprise when I was sent to clean an apartment near the Museum of Modern Art. The woman who lived there was in her late 60s and had hair the color of a newly hatched chick. Mrs. Oakley, I'll say her name was. She wore a denim skirt with a matching blouse and had knotted a red bandana around her throat. With some people, this might be it, their look. But on her, it seemed like a costume, like she was going to a party with a cattle rustling theme. Most often, a homeowner would take my jacket or direct me toward the closet. Mrs. Oakley did neither, and when I made for the brass rack that she herself clearly used, she said, "Not there," her voice a bark. "You can put your things in the guest bathroom, not on the countertop, but on the toilet." She pointed to a door at the end of the foyer. "Put the lid down first," she told me. "Then put your coat and scarf on top of the lid." I wondered who would be stupid enough not to have understood that, and I imagined a simpleton with a puzzled expression on his face. "Hey," he might say, "how come my jacket's all wet? And while we're at it, who put this turd in my pocket?" "Something amuses you, does it?" Mrs. Oakley asked. I said, "No, not at all." Then I jotted down the time in my portable notebook.
She saw me writing and put her hands on her hips. "I am not paying you to practice your English," she told me.
"Excuse me?"
She pointed to my notebook. "This is not a language institute. You are here to work, not to learn new words."
"But I'm an American," I told her. "I spoke English before I got here, like at home, growing up and stuff."
Mrs. Oakley sniffed but did not apologize. I think she wanted a foreigner so badly that she heard an accent where there was none. How else to explain it? Being a desperate, godforsaken immigrant, it went without saying that I coveted everything before me. The white wall-to-wall carpet. The framed reproduction of Renoir's Brat with Watering Can. The gold-plated towel rack in the marbled master bathroom. "I have very nice things," she announced, "and I expect to still have them after you've left." Was this the moment I decided to make up with Helen? Or was it later, when Mrs. Oakley screamed at me for opening the medicine cabinet?
"When I told you to clean the master bathroom, I meant everything but that. What are you, an idiot?"
The end of the day, I caught the subway home. Helen was staring down from her window as I approached our building, and when I waved at her, she waved back. 3 minutes later, I was sitting at her kitchen table. So then she told me, "I have very nice things, and I expect to still have them after you've left."
"Oh, she was asking for it, that one," Helen said.
"What did she say when you slapped her?"
"I didn't slap her."
She looked disappointed. "Okay, then. What did you break on your way out?"
"Nothing. I mean, I didn't walk out."
"Are you telling me you stayed and took that shit?"
"Well, sure."
"Then what the fuck?" She lit a fresh cigarette and tucked her disposable lighter back into her pack. "What the fuck are you good for?" The first time I went to Normandy, I stayed for 3 weeks. After returning, I went straight to Helen's, but she refused to hear about it. "The French are faggots," she said. As evidence, she brought up Bernard, who was born in Nice and lived on the fourth floor. "Bernard's not a homosexual," I told her.
"Maybe not, but he's filthy. Did you ever see his apartment?"
"No."
"Okay then, so shut up."
This was her way of saying that the argument was over and that she had won.
"I bet you're glad to be back, though. You couldn't pay me to go overseas. I like it where it's civilized and you can drink the water without running to the toilet every 5 minutes.
While in France, I'd bought Helen some presents, nothing big or expensive, just little things a person could use and then throw away. I placed a bag of gifts on her kitchen table, and she half-heartedly pawed through it, holding the objects upside down and sideways, the way a monkey might. A miniature roll of paper towels, disposable napkins with H's printed on them, kitchen sponges tailored to fit the shape of the hand. "I don't have any use for this crap," she said. "Take it away, I don't want it." I put the gifts back into the bag, ashamed at how deeply my feelings were hurt. "Most people, most humans, receive a present and say thank you," I told her.
"Not when they get garbage like that, they don't," she said.
In fact, these things were perfect for her, but Helen wouldn't accept them for the same reason she wouldn't accept anything. The other person had to owe and be beholden forever. I tossed the rejected presents back into the bag and headed for the door.
"You know what you have," I said. "You have a gift disorder."
"A what?"
"It's like an eating disorder, only with presents."
"Take that back," she said.
"My point exactly."
And then I left, slamming the door behind me. Helen knocked on January 1st, just as I was leaving for a cleaning job. "Work on New Year's Day and you'll work every day of the year," she told me. "It's a truth you can ask anybody." I wondered for a moment if she was right, and then I considered the last little truism she had passed my way. "You won't get a hangover if you sleep with the TV on." She also claimed you could prevent crib death by making the sign of the cross 3 times with a steak knife.
"If you're camping, could you use a Swiss Army knife instead?" I asked. She looked at me and shook her head. Who the fuck goes camping with a baby? Helen was shaking out her pills, the ones for her heart and her high blood pressure, the pain in her side and the new one in her right leg. Trips to the doctor were her only ticket out of the apartment, and after each visit she'd spend hours on the phone, haranguing the people at Medicare. When that got old, she'd phone McKay's drugstore and have a go at the pharmacist. I'd like to cut his balls off and stuff him down his throat, she told me. Now there were new pills she needed to take. I offered to pick them up for her, and along with the prescription, she handed me a receipt. It seemed her enemy at McKay's had overcharged her for her last order, so after getting this new one, I was to tell the hook-nosed Jew bastard that he owed my neighbor 4 cents. I was then to suggest that he shove his delivery charge up his fat ass. Got that? Helen asked. I was happy to pick up the medicine, but when it came to the disputed bill, and toward the end there was always a dispute, I'd make it up out of my own pocket and lie when she prodded me for details. The pharmacist said he was very sorry and that it won't happen again, I'd tell her. Did you tell him what he can do with his delivery charge? I sure did. And what did he say? Pardon? When you told him to shove it up his ass, what did he say? He said, I bet that's gonna hurt. You're damn right it will, she'd say. Back when she could still get up and down the stairs, Helen had all the run-ins she could handle. On the bus, at the post office, wherever peace reigned, she shattered it. Now she had to import her prey, delivery men, most of them. The ones from the Grand Union, the supermarket we favored, tended to be African, recent immigrants from Chad and Ghana. You black bastards, I'd hear her yell. You think I don't know what you're up to? She hit bottom when she physically attacked the deaf mute. This was a boy of 14, a beloved neighborhood figure, who delivered for the nearby deli. How could you? Hugh scolded. What do you expect me to do when somebody's stealing my things? She asked. What am I just supposed to stand there and do nothing? It eventually came out that by stealing, she meant that he had borrowed her pen. After using it to tally the bill, he stuck it in his shirt pocket, absent-mindedly, most likely. Helen reacted by pulling his hair and digging her nails into his neck. But not hard, she said. There was hardly any blood at all. When asked why the boy would steal a 30-cent pen, a pen he could surely get for free at his father's store, Helen sighed, exhausted at having to explain the obvious. He's Portuguese, she said. You know what those bastards are like. You've seen them. But there was a hint of desperation to her voice, the fear that maybe this time she had gone too far. The following morning, she called our apartment and asked almost sheepishly if I'd rub in some tiger balm for her. I crossed the hall, and after letting me in, she took a seat and pointed out her sore shoulder. I think I sprained it smacking that little freak, she said. It was February 14th, Valentine's Day, and after a few more words about the delivery boy, Helen's thoughts turned to love, or more specifically, to my father. He'd visited me the previous autumn, and she'd been talking about him ever since. That Lou is a very good-looking man. Too bad you didn't get any of his genes. Well, I'm sure I got some of them, I told her. No, you didn't. You must take after your mother. And she's dead, right? Yes, she's dead. You know we're the same age, me and Lou. Is he dating anybody? The thought of my father and Helen together made the bottoms of my feet sweat. No, he's not dating anyone, and he's not going to, either. No need to get so sensitive, she said. Jesus, I was only asking. And then she lowered her shirt a little and asked me to do her back. I just returned from another trip to the pharmacy when Helen asked me to dab some white shoe polish on her kitchen ceiling. A slight stain had formed, and she insisted that it was dog urine, leaking down from the apartment above her. The sons of bitches,
They think that if they ruin my ceiling, it'll drive me into a nursing home. I don't remember why I didn't do it. Maybe I had someone waiting for me, or perhaps I'd just had enough for one day. I'll do it tomorrow, I told her. And as I shut the door, I heard her say, "Right, you and your tomorrows." It was Joe who found her. Helen kept a sawed-off 2x4 in her kitchen, a weapon against possible intruders, and he awoke to hear her banging it against the inside of her door. He had a key in case of emergency and entered the apartment to find her on the floor. Beside her was the overturned step stool, and beneath the kitchen table, lying just out of reach, was a bottle of white shoe polish. On One Life to Live, and all soap operas really, the characters are forever blaming themselves. The male lead is nearly killed in a car accident, and as the surgeons do what they can to save him, the family gathers in the waiting room to accept responsibility. "It was my fault," the ex-wife says. "I never should have upset him with news about the baby." She starts to bang her head against the wall and is stopped by the lead's father. "Don't be stupid. If anyone's to blame, it's me." Then the girlfriend horns in and decides that it's all her fault. In the end, the only one who won't feel guilty is the driver of the other car.
"Why the heck would she stand on a chair to polish her shoes?" Joe asked as the ambulance headed off towards St. Vincent's. "That's what I can't figure out."
"Me neither," I said. During the next few months, Hugh and I visited Helen in the hospital. The problem wasn't her broken hip, but the series of strokes that followed her operation. It was as if she had been struck by lightning. That's how fried and out of it she was. Unable to put a sentence together, she'd also been literally defanged. No teeth, no glasses. And when the last of the henna had faded, her hair, like her face, was the color of old cement. The hospital room was small and hot. Near the door was a second bed, and in it lay a Dominican woman who had recently lost a leg. Every time I was there, she pointed to Helen's food tray and begged, "Is she going to eat that applesauce? Do you think she wants those crackers? If not, I'll take them." Had Helen been her old self, this woman would have been missing a lot more than a leg. As it was, the roommate left no more of an impression than the wall-mounted TV, which was permanently tuned to the bullshit station and was on all the time. At the funeral were people I had heard about but never met. Helen once told me that as a young woman, her nickname had been Rocky, as in Graziano, the fighter. But according to her sister, she was called any number of things.
"To me, she was always Baby Hippo, on account of her great big behind," she told me. "I'd call her that, and oh, she used to get so mad."
Most everyone I met had a good anger story. Helen cursing, Helen smacking, Helen slamming down the phone. In the months after she died, these were the moments I'd recalled as well. Gradually, though, the focus shifted, and instead of Helen attacking a deaf mute, I'd picture her the following morning, sitting in her kitchen as I applied the tiger balm. It was such a strange thing for her to have, let alone say. "It's Oriental," she told me. "I think the Chinese invented it." I'm not a terribly physical person. Helen wasn't either. We'd never hugged or even shaken hands, so it was odd to find myself rubbing her bare shoulder and then her back. It was, I thought, like stroking some sort of a sea creature, the flesh slick and fatty beneath my palms. In my memory, there was something on the stove, a cauldron of tomato gravy, and the smell of it mixed with the camphor of the tiger balm. The windows were steamed. Tony Bennett was on the radio and saying please, her voice catching on the newness of the word. Helen asked me to turn it up.